Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm co-producer Nancy Roth. We're continuing with the memoir, How to Be a Sister, a love story with a twist of autism, read by the author, Eileen Garvin.
Chapter 8, The Know-Nothing Aunt. We often save our best manners for company, and even for strangers, giving less than our best to our family and friends. How unfortunate that is, since these are the relationships that matter most in our lives. On Relationships, Emily posts etiquette. I couldn't sleep, partly because I was in a strange bed. From a horizontal vantage point on the hide-a-bed in my sister Anne's living room, I lay awake for hours, gazing at framed pictures, carved wooden figurines, and shapely Asian ceramic bowls. The trappings of a life that had taken Anne from a small town in Washington State to Germany, and then the Mojave Desert and Boston, and China, and back again to the United States. I was thinking about the work it must have taken to haul these items from place to place as the U.S. Army moved her family around so frequently over the past two decades. Even though they had been living in this particular house for only a couple of months, this stuff was here, hammered and hung, measured and straightened, looking like it had never been anywhere else. I wondered if Anne looked at these items as a way to mark her place in the world, the touchstone she'd carefully collected to make herself at home, no matter where on the globe she might be. Or maybe it's just a bunch of crap that she hauls around out of habit and that she secretly wishes would get lost or damaged in the move. As I lay there not sleeping, ruminating on her family's travels, I was also thinking about how having children seems to make people's guest rooms disappear. Suddenly, all the bedrooms are chock full of children. There is no sleeping space for visiting adults, so people like me get stuck out on the couch or some air mattress in the middle of the house while the children are all snuggled up in their private suites with extra pillows and the luxury of a door that closes. I'd driven 300 miles that afternoon and was hoping for, no, expecting, a room of my own. I felt a bit like an old crone for thinking such things, but I also felt a bit like I'd been left out on the lawn with the sprinkler and scattered toys, exposed, neglected, stepped on. The soft mattress under me slanted down at the top, which made all the blood in my body rush toward my head. This was an uncomfortable sensation, to say the least, not to mention the fact that I could feel each horizontal steel bar beneath me. However, I had convinced myself that my position was probably not dangerous, unless my head slid further down into the crease between the mattress and the back of the couch, causing the hide-a-bed to suddenly engage and put itself away. But I was trying not to let myself think about that sort of thing. Mostly, I couldn't sleep because there was a pair of 7-year-old feet lodged in the middle of my spine. The feet belonged to my carrot-haired nephew, Tony, who had asked his mother if he could sleep in the hide-a-bed, what he called the Big Nana Pat bed, with Auntie Eileen. She hadn't actually cleared this request with me. She just mentioned it with a smile and went to tuck him in, leaving me standing in the kitchen, wondering to myself if there is a polite way to tell a 7-year-old that you don't relish his nocturnal company. Turns out there isn't. Besides, by the time I went to bed, Tony had been asleep for hours. Now here he was, snoring gently in my ear and digging his little toes into my road-weary back. My nephew is an adorable little person. It's just that I have long had a strong aversion to sharing a bed with anyone. Even Brendan barely made the cut. As a child, I was forced to share a room with two sisters until the oldest one, this kid's mom, Anne, went away to college. That left Margaret and me bunking together for another 5 years until I left for school. Even after all this time, I still jealously guard my own space. When traveling with a large group of my girlfriends, I'll happily sleep on the floor before volunteering to share a bed. When they ask why, I try to explain that I don't like to be looked at when I'm sleeping. People tell me this is a ridiculous fear, because when people sleep together, they are sleeping, not looking at each other. But those people never had to share a room with Margaret. Being watched in my sleep, it's a worry I had nurtured nightly through the 18 years I shared a room with my autistic sister, this kid's other aunt, who was 3 years my senior and seemed to never sleep. She had disrupted my rest for nearly 2 decades with her nocturnal wanderings and strange whisperings. I often woke to the sound of her feet thundering down the stairs to check on something, as she was wont to do in her compulsive and unpredictable nighttime travels. My older brothers and I would try to police this kind of activity, because we didn't want her to wake up our dad, who was sleep-deprived during the entire course of his career as an obstetrician, and would come roaring up the stairs in that signature, scary dad in underwear way that men of his generation had perfected. If he awoke, we were doomed. Therefore, if one of us heard Margaret getting out of bed, we'd all leap up to chase her. Consequently, Margaret developed a habit of running and slamming doors behind her as she went, because she knew someone would be hot on her heels trying to get her to go back to bed. Even if we didn't chase her, when we'd long given up on this tactic, she'd run and slam because she'd gotten used to doing so. Slap, slam, slam, wham, 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 wham. Her feet would hit the floor and she'd be out of bed, through two doors, down the stairs, through the living room, into the kitchen, and back again. As she thundered back up the stairs to the second floor, where we kids slept, I'd hear my mother's quiet scolding, "Margaret, now you go to bed." Sometimes this was, in fact, my mother, following Margaret up the stairs to make sure she went back to bed. But sometimes Margaret would rush back up the stairs on her own, scolding herself in a perfect imitation of our mother's voice, saving Mom the trouble of getting out of bed. It was kind of like Gilligan hitting himself with Skipper's hat when he knew he'd done something dumb. Weekend mornings were worse when I tried to make up for lost sleep. Margaret would roll out of bed much earlier than I did, anxiety propelling her into her clothes and down the stairs into the kitchen. And there she'd pace, waiting for the rest of us to follow her so that she could begin another day-long session of record playing from the eclectic family collection: Bay City Rollers, Electric Light Orchestra, Roger Whittaker, Carmina Burana. There was little peace to be had in a house with five children living in it, and my sister's habits just increased the sense of chaos. Even so, our mother did what she could to set some kind of boundary with the records. Margaret was allowed to turn on her music when the other kids get up. Of course, as I've said before, waiting for anything was very difficult for Margaret. Her anxiety-fueled pacing and talking to my mother shook the walls and rattled the doorknobs, but to be fair, the music stayed off. Sometimes I lie there, listening to her ask my mother, "You're going to play the music, Mom?" And my mother would answer, "When the other kids get up." I'd hear Margaret walk away, sit on the couch with a thump, and about 10 seconds would pass before she'd get up, hurry into the kitchen, and ask, "You're going to play the music, Mom?" My mother would repeat the same answer, cheerfully, endlessly, it seemed. "When the other kids get up, then you can play the music, Margaret. When the other kids get up, then you can play the music, Mom." "That's right, Margs. Then you can play the music. Then you can play the music, Margs. Then you can play the music, Mom. Then you can play the music, Margs." After a certain period of time, Margaret just couldn't stand it anymore. She'd sprint into the kitchen and switch on the stereo at full volume for a split second, blasting music through the house. Before someone yelled at her to turn it down, she'd already turned it off again. Of course, I was no longer sleeping after that, but I clung stubbornly to my right to be in bed, and I kept my eyes shut tight. Often, Margaret would start checking on me to see if I was moving. I'd pretend like I was asleep as she pounded up the stairs and shuffled to my bedside. Then she'd just stand there, breathing on me. I'd look at her through my lashes, always sensing that she knew I was faking my slumber. Some days her face would be pulled into lines of worry, and she'd stand there twisting her hands, looking like she was about to cry or scream. On other days, I would see her mischievous smile. "You can play the music when the kids get up," she'd say loudly, in my face. And if I so much as flickered an eyelash, she'd pounce on me, rolling around on the bed and laughing. Then she'd sprint down the stairs to crank up the stereo. "You're going to listen to the music when Eileen gets up, Mom," she'd holler up from the kitchen in her high monotone voice, and I'd be, against my will, up. I've never quite recovered from those days. I still hide my face in the morning, only now I'm hiding from my dog, who starts pawing at my shoulder if she sees me move, hoping to expedite a quicker breakfast. I feign sleep around the cats, one of which starts knocking pictures off the walls or flinging my glasses and other bedside items if she thinks there's a chance I'll rise up and open the window for her. The other one wanting me to fill her very special water bowl in the bathroom and crying and pacing if she sees me awake. Yes, it's true. I'm a grown woman who feels the need to deceive her pets. But I hide from my husband, too, who, like Margaret, always wants to get up early on the weekends. So far, he's been easier to fool with the pretending to be asleep bit. All of this is to say that sleep-related anxiety makes me pretty keen to avoid shared sleeping arrangements. If I sleep alone, I don't have to worry about being watched or, consequently, try to hide the fact that I'm worried about it. But no such luck this time. Here I was, trapped by the enthusiasm of a sweet young boy. As I lay awake, I knew I should be flattered by the attention. At least I wasn't some scary relative that everyone hid from. The aunt with the hairy mole, the aunt who chews with her mouth open, the aunt with the BO who hugs way too much. Tony was young enough to take it for granted that he liked me just because I was his auntie. He was too young to make any critical sort of judgment about me as a person. I was just an aunt. For this, I knew I should be grateful. I took a deep breath and tried to focus on the gratitude, but I moved in the wrong direction and felt a muscle in my lower back start to spasm. While I waited for the pain to pass, it occurred to me that there weren't too many years left for Tony to be so cuddly. As the youngest of my sister's three kids, he tolerated the babying, snuggling, and hand-holding. But his big brother was on the football team. His dad was in the military, and I knew a time was coming when the little man in him wouldn't stand for any of it. He'd rise up and throw off the sweet bonds of women's affection, at least while other people were looking. As I finished this thought, Tony kicked me in his sleep, and my spine twanged like a loosely strung violin. My sleeplessness intensified, and I realized that in just a few short hours, I was going to have to face a room full of alert family members, and I was pretty sure there wasn't any coffee in the house. This thought terrified me into full wakefulness. I thought about climbing the stairs into Tony's room and taking over his twin bed so that I would get enough sleep to communicate with my relatives long enough to find out where the nearest coffee shop was. Then a powerful thought came to me and superseded the caffeine problem. I'm never going to have one of these, I thought. I'll never have a little boy of my own. Suddenly, I felt completely calm and aware. I don't have any children, and it's unlikely that I ever will. I often ponder the advantages of this decision, but at that moment, as Tony pitched on his side and threw me an elbow, all I could think of was the loss it brought. The realization pierced me sharply just then, and the little feet didn't bother me anymore. And after a while, I fell asleep. The reason I was in the big Nana Pat bed in the first place was that I was on an auntly errand, one I probably wouldn't have been able to perform if I'd had kids of my own, in fact. Anne, whose husband was out of the country, had asked me to stay with her three children, Bobby, Julia, and Tony, while she attended a class in another town. My mission was simple. Pick the little kids up from school, be home when Bobby got home from carpool, feed them dinner, make sure they did their homework, and keep them alive until they left for school the next morning. Then I was off the hook. I had accepted, but with a pang of fear in my heart. As a childless freelance writer, I lead a rather simple life. My day is centered on the coffee pot and a hot shower. I wander around in my bathrobe for the better part of the morning, and if you took away my computer and replaced it with a television, people watching what I do all day would say loser instead of writer. It's all relative. Despite the simplicity of my solitary routine, I can make a part-time job out of letting the cats in and out on a given day. Being responsible for humans was another matter entirely, but I wanted to do it, so I'd said yes and tried to feel brave. For an hour or so after I arrived at their house, I just stood in the middle of the kitchen, wide-eyed. Living with children must make you feel like your house is haunted, I thought. Around every corner of Anne's house was the sound of a person or a pile of that person's stuff, a recently vacated chair sliding across the floor, an electronic device just turned on, the shadow of a child disappearing around a corner, the flash of a shirt tail, a sock heel. It seemed like they were in constant motion, so I stood still, clutching my glass of wine, and tried to pay attention to the directions my sister was giving while she made dinner. She'd get about halfway through some complex explanation about their education, healthcare, or spiritual well-being, and then she'd look up at me and say, "Oh, you know what I'm talking about." I was too overwhelmed to say, "Do I? Are you sure?" As we sat together enjoying the meal she'd prepared, my confusion intensified. It seemed like they all talked at the same time, but that could have been the wine. My sister mediated the conversation by asking each of them to tell the rest of us three things they'd done that day. Bobby was taking his turn when I heard Tony making a funny noise, and when I looked at him, I realized he was choking. Before I could even think of what to do, he opened his mouth to breathe. A warm mist of milk sprayed across the table and showered my hair, shoulders, and chest. I sat there, milky beads cascading down the wails of my corduroy shirt, not reacting. There was a moment of silence, and then they all dissolved with laughter, my sister laughing the loudest. The four of them pounded on the table and gasped for air, unable to speak. I reached up with my napkin and dabbed at the milk pooling in my collarbone, calmly patted my hair, and waited for them to be quiet. After a minute or two, it occurred to me that it was really hilarious to have milk in my hair, and I started to chuckle, which made them laugh even harder. Then I really got going and snorted so loud that Tony nearly spewed milk all over me again. Eventually, we pulled ourselves together and finished dinner. Thank God there was a parent there to lead us through. It's times like this when I feel like my emotional comprehension runs about 2 minutes behind everyone else's, and when you think about the nuances of humor, grief, or anger, that's a lot of time. This lag time was kind of trained into me as a kid when I had spent years trying not to respond to some antic of my sister's. For instance, Margaret always got a huge kick out of spitting her juice in our faces at the dinner table. Some of her jokes would come and go after a few days or weeks, like chin pinching or hair pulling, but this one stuck around for years. As we five kids sat crowded around our sticky dining room table, one of us would feel the weight of her eyes upon us and unwillingly turn to look at her. She'd blow like a spouting whale just inches away. Then she'd laugh and laugh, and our mother would tell us not to react because it would only encourage her to do it more. So we'd just sit there with water or juice running down our cheeks and take another bite of canned corn or beans while she loaded up and did it all over again. Sometimes I get angry and yell at her, which usually made her laugh harder, and she'd say something like, "You don't spit your juice, Eileen, that's good manners," and then she'd spit on me again. She also loved to grab the gallon jug of milk out of the refrigerator and pour it down the drain to make a scream. "No, Margaret, don't pour the milk out!" This also made her laugh. And we were not supposed to respond as she hollered, "You don't pour the milk out, ha ha ha!" We spent a lot of time not reacting to Margaret's kooky jokes, and I don't think it's made a bit of difference. I love her, and she's shaped my life in ways that I continue to try to understand. But when I was young, mostly I felt like I wanted to kill her when she did this sort of thing. In college, when I read The Myth of Sisyphus, I felt an immediate kinship. I knew what it was like to do the same thing over and over again, to go beyond exhaustion with the repetition of some meaningless task, and to wake up the next day and do it all over again without any hope of reprieve. That's how I felt when we, as a family, were trying to teach Margaret to do or not do something. I always think about Margaret when I'm around other people's children because I was one of the many people who helped bring her up. Although I'm 3 years younger than she, I am, for all intents and purposes, her big sister, and it's the only frame of reference I have for child rearing. I realize it's not a conservative comparison, but it's all I've got. Tony, unlike Margaret, only spit on me the one time, and I came to recognize that it was an accident, although after the response he got, you could tell he really wanted to do it again. After Anne left for her class, I kept reminding myself that these three children were not like my unpredictable sister. They were fairly reasonable little people. They had rules and a moral code. They might have been a bit too focused on keeping score. Who ate the last cookie? Whose turn it was for Xbox? Who got to pick the last movie? But at least they all followed the same basic playbook with a range of rules. What is allowed? What is not allowed? And what Aunt Eileen might not know is not allowed. This last category left me at a serious disadvantage. The rules and regulations of the childhood code of ethics seemed to have left me, and I felt panicked. I thought I was supposed to have some kind of answer to their nonstop negotiating for sugary snacks, television, a later bedtime, or their turn with a toy. The internal bickering and massive power struggles made me feel like Colin Powell during the Bush administration. I was supposed to have the answers, but no one was listening to me. But I soon realized that I didn't have to say much, if anything at all. These kids knew what was right and wrong within the family charter, even if I didn't. I found that if I didn't say anything and just looked knowingly at them, they came to the answer on their own. This tactic kept the peace and gave the illusion, at least, that I was on to them. To be fair, they didn't give me any real trouble because they are good kids. They moved around in the migratory army life: California, Massachusetts, Virginia, Beijing, Virginia again, Hong Kong, Virginia one last time, and now Washington State. Through all that, they've hung together. They are kind to one another and still play together, even the boys, who are separated by 7 years. And did they ever play? This was a gaming family. On the first night, the three of them tried to teach me to play chess, a game I have never even tried, but which is a passion for my husband. It made me shudder, the anonymous-looking pieces in the blank board, which somehow inspired very mysterious, specific moves. Where were the chutes and ladders, the lollipop forest, the metal wheelbarrow, and the Scotty dog? But Bobby, Tony, and Julia were good little teachers. Plus, we were using the Lord of the Rings chess set with its recognizable orcs and wizards and such, not those neutered-looking wooden pegs. I was actually starting to catch on, and then I won by default when Tony, who'd been beating me soundly, fell victim to teasing from his older brother, got pissed off, and threw the board. On the second night, they asked me what I wanted to play after dinner. And I said, "What do you have?" "Risk," they said, and Murder in the Abbey, Scattergories, and Cranium. I said I didn't know how to play any of those, but I'd be willing to learn. Tony slapped the table with an open palm like he just about had it with me. "Aunt Eileen, you don't know anything," he exclaimed. The older kids looked at me to see if I was going to get mad. I'm pretty sure there's a rule in the family charter about how you are supposed to address adults, but by this time I decided that I mostly fell in the middle ground regarding this sort of etiquette. I'm not a parent, and I'm not a child, but I feel a closer kinship to the children, especially when I'm sleeping on a hide-a-bed in the middle of the living room. So I just smiled at Tony and told him that was okay. It was okay I didn't know anything, because I had him to teach me. That's the truth, too. These kids taught me something every time I saw them. I learned not to be terrified if Julia asked me to brush her beautiful auburn hair in the morning. I used to flee the comb myself and remember the unkind pull of the sharp teeth in my own snarly young locks. I was afraid I would hurt her. But this kid was resilient. I brushed, I braided, and I wasn't half bad at it. She smiled at me and told me I did a pretty good job. With Tony, I learned to trust that I would know what to say when he padded into the kitchen at 10 p.m. in his little Spider-Man pajamas to tell me he couldn't sleep, that I would find some trick in my auntie toolbox to comfort him enough so that he'd be able to slide into bed and burrow his head down like a small animal, wearing the remnant of his security blanket like a scarf. And he showed me that I can get over my ancient hang-ups, like sharing a bed with somebody else and not minding if I don't sleep very well. And then there was Bobby, the stoic eldest. When I went to bed and saw his light on upstairs, I thought about his lonely breakfast that morning in the dark kitchen. He had to leave at 7 a.m. each day for high school in the next town over, and at 14 was getting himself up and out the door on his own. I worried that I'd been too serious about following my sister's instructions about the rules. So I got out of bed and climbed up the stairs. I poked my head in through his open door and saw Bobby with his headphones on, doing his homework. I pointed at the clock and called him the family vampire. That made him smile. We talked about how fun it is to stay up late and how hard it is to get up in the morning. He told me about what he was working on, a critique for his creative writing class. I didn't say much. I didn't know what to say, but I just wanted him to know that I saw him, that I recognized him, and that I could see the person he is always becoming. The next morning, I listened to Bobby trying to get up for an hour. 5:45 a.m., 6 a.m., 6:15 a.m., 6:30 a.m., his alarm shouting me awake every 15 minutes. Alarm, snooze, alarm, snooze. I dragged myself into the kitchen to make some coffee at 7 a.m. and told him he should get a medal for getting up so early. Before he left, I put my arms around him and told him to come visit me in Oregon soon. Julia and Tony held my hands on the way to school, and I loved the feeling of their smooth little paws. More than that, I loved the feeling of trust, their cheerful assumption that I love them back, which I do immensely. They let go of me and jumped up to walk the rock wall next to the sidewalk, all the while chatting away to me, not missing a step. At the school, I watched them head into their separate classrooms and into a day that would become part of a lifetime as it piled up on the other days that had come before it. And I hoped my short time with them would be a good memory in that pile. I drove home through the Pacific Northwest rain, dodging semi-trucks and puddles, thinking of their red gold hair, their sweet faces, their laughter. I thought about my sister and her husband, the architects of their children's characters. How do you do it? I wondered. How do you figure out the right rules to sustain you through a day, a year, or a lifetime? When do you know you're teaching them how to become the people they were born to be, and when are you getting in their way? Is it the success of the day-to-day or the crisis that proves it to you? How do you encourage them to do things their own way, and how do you stand back and let them fail, knowing that it is just one small part of who they will become? Soon I was back in my quiet house with my needy cats and my patient dog. Nobody wanted to play with me. They just wanted food, water, and the couch. After climbing the stairs that night, I was happy to be in my own bed, but I missed the warmth and weight of Tony dreaming next to me. My house was full of the dark and the silence that comes from the absence of children. And even after all of these years, I felt the quiet created by Margaret's absence. I knew then that having Margaret as a sister played some part in my decision not to have children. It's not that I was worried about giving birth to a child with disabilities. The odds are against it. And the rational part of me knew that raising a non-autistic child wouldn't be as difficult. A child could learn and grow and change in ways that might seem like magic to me after watching Margaret struggle to learn the kinds of things we take for granted. Look at people when you talk to them. Eat your food in small bites. Get dressed before you come out of the locker room. Don't spank Father Bach or run a fingertip up ladies' pantyhose on the way back from communion. My mother, Margaret's teachers, and countless others worked with her over the years, and so did the rest of us family members. There was so much that she could never master, and in trying to help teach her, I had always felt like I was failing over and over again. It was not rational, but I knew it was part of the reason I'd chosen not to be a parent. I wouldn't ever know what my life would have been like if I'd made a different choice, but that was something I had to live with, just as we all live with our choices. There was so much I didn't know. I still didn't know how to play chess, and I didn't care if I ever did. I didn't know what it took to raise a child to feel loved and safe and independent. I didn't know what Margaret's life was really like, if she was happy, if she thought of me. I often wished I could have found more reserves of humor and laughter for her, for me, when we were sharing a house. I tried to remember when I first got the notion that I was responsible for her behavior and for her future. I asked myself if all that time I thought I was working so hard to help her had made any difference at all. I wondered if I'd really done anything at all besides worry. Some of these were questions I was not sure I wanted to know the answers to. There were a few things I did know. I was pretty sure I'd never be a mother, but I also knew what it was to be an aunt and a sister, and that meant a great deal to me. I loved watching my sister and her husband succeed at this important task. I was also beginning to realize that our lives are our own to shape and heal as well as we are able. If we are lucky, we have people we love and call family. As for my siblings, I was learning to hope that I could have adult relationships with each of them now that we lived closer. And I decided to try to let go of my expectations about what those relationships should be like. I decided to just see what would happen. As for all those things that remain mysterious and unknown, I could only hope that I would be paying attention if the answers ever revealed themselves. That night, I lay in bed, not sleeping in my quiet house. Outside, I could hear the eternal wind of the Columbia River Gorge rushing over the peak of the roof and squealing around the corner eaves. I closed my eyes and listened to the whistling dark. And then I was falling toward sleep, holding the two of them, Margaret and Tony, in my mind's eye. Here is Margaret, rushing through the dark hallway in her flannel nightgown like the wind itself, gripping a tattered record cover in one hand and scolding herself in a whisper. And here is Tony, muttering in his sleep, clutching his tattered baby blanket to his chest. I saw them, and I saw the truth. We hold so tightly to what we treasure, not knowing that grasping what is precious to us only makes it fall away faster, not realizing that if we would loosen our hold, the objects of our affections would become lighter than the air we breathe, more magical than our dreams, more constant than sleep, and in that we can find rest.
You've been listening to How to Be a Sister, a Love Story with a Twist of Autism by Eileen Garvin, published in 2010 by the Experiment Publishing of New York, and read by the author. You can get more information on the author and the book on Google, Eileen Garvin, G-A-R-V-I-N. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. Executive producer is Vern Windham. Thanks to our two fine technical editors, Ellie Hawkett and Caitlin Webster. They're from the Lewis and Clark PICI class. I'm producer Nancy Roth.